Hey there, folks. Want to tell you about a new podcast that's coming out. It's called Shut Up and Dribble. You know, the phrase shut up and dribble became a cultural phenomenon. It's ironic in a way that it became a rallying cry for all athletes, not just basketball, to do the opposite, to not just shut up and dribble. Anyways, the show is about the intersection between basketball, society, business, and pop culture. It's more than the schemes, stats, X's and O's. And some of the big questions talked about will be, how is the NBA addressing current social and political issues as an organization? And why are the ratings in decline? And what does it mean to be an activist athlete in today's climate? These are just some of the big ideas talked about in this show, and it's hosted by Jeffrey Lin. And Jeffrey is a big basketball fan, but he's also very attuned to what's going on in the world. So the show is coming out soon from Fengjian Productions on October 7th and all podcast platforms. Pretty much wherever you listen to podcasts, search Shut Up and Dribble. The following pod contains spoilers. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, listener. I want to tell you about this new and exciting app we're on. It's called Shuffle. Shuffle allows you, the listener, to not just listen to our episodes, but also allows you to edit and snip audio clips, add visual elements, react, even share in your socials of specific moments of each episode. One of the reasons why I love Shuffle is that it's focused on the community aspect for podcast lovers. Because, you know, sometimes listening to an episode can feel a little bit lonely. Let's say you're working near a colleague or commuting on public transportation and you've got your AirPods on and you hear something funny or interesting from your podcast and you're smiling and you're giggling by yourself. All of a sudden you start getting strange looks from everyone. The person next to you gets up and sits somewhere else. And now everyone on the train thinks you're crazy. Well, guess what? You're no longer alone, because with the Shuffle app, you can react and enjoy those moments with other listeners. We have a new community chat out there for all you fans who love AAPI cinema. You can chat with other fans, ask us questions, get film recommendations, or even recommend us films. Right now, we have a special offer for you. Shuffle is offering to sponsor 10 of our fans their first month on our Patreon. All you have to do is download the Shuffle app, join the Real Asian Podcast community chat, sign up for our Patreon, and we'll take care of the rest. We'll select 10 random people to sponsor their first month. That's right. We're so confident you'll enjoy the app and our content that we'll take care of the first month. So to join the community today, go to realasianpodcast.com/shuffle. Again, super easy to remember, realasianpodcast.com/shuffle.
Hey, Baldwin, you know, I was thinking about how I love talking about Asian things. Do you also yearn for a community to be able to do that?
You know, I'm not in a community that has that content available, but there is a solution for that, and that's the Universal Asian.
What kind of content do they have there?
So they got a whole bunch of things, but it's a magazine style publication that has written articles. They got poetry, prose, photos, art, and even some videos about Asian American culture or just Asian culture.
Oh, that's awesome. So where do I find out about this community?
You can actually go to theuniversalasian.com and you could visit and subscribe to them. And do you actually have Instagram?
I do.
Yeah, that's great. So you could actually follow them at The Universal Asian. Look them up right now and join the Universal Asian community today.
Thank you. Hey everyone, my name is Renee Yah, and I'm in today for Raymond Liu, who is our producer and host extraordinaire. Today we're going to be talking about The Namesake, and today I'm going to be joined by Saba.
Hi, I'm Saba Razvi, and I'm a writer and a professor of literature. I'm really interested in speculative literature, and one of the things I like to explore is how Asian American culture shows up in literature and film and music and other things like that. So I'm really excited to talk about The Namesake today because I think it's a really interesting film with some cool stuff. I write a little bit about this topic as well, so you can look up some of my work if you're interested and follow up and reach out to me.
Oh my God, I'm so excited for you to be here and join us, Saba. I've known you for, God, okay, at least a year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, basically one of my side gigs at that time was I was also the secretary for the Science Fiction Fantasy Poetry Association, and we were trying to run our first Zoom reading, and you know, technical hiccups and all, we did it. And so that's when I met Saba, and I've just been obsessed with her ever since.
Thank you. I'm obsessed with you too.
Thanks. So I'm so happy to have you join us. You know, one of the things that I love about just like about the, I guess, the universe that we orbit within each other is the fact that basically like that speculative kind of, you know, I you don't see a lot of like Asian representation, especially in like the American audience for speculative. Mm-hmm. I mean, and some of my favorite like sci-fi fantasy kind of movies kind of come from like Asian cultures. And so, God, what was one of them that I'm thinking of right now? It's Pterapods Come. Like, oh God, I feel bad. Like, I get Arrivals. Is that what it's? Yeah.
Yes, the Arrivals.
Oh mm-hmm. my God, that was so great. Amazing. And that was written by a Chinese author, you know. And mm-hmm. so I really feel like you know, we're entering in this weird space that I would love to kind of explore. But that's not today. Today we're here to talk about the namesake.
Right. And that one is really interesting because you see like the grounding of language and the background of that film's yes. construction. There's so many different avenues to explore within this kind of network of topics and discussions that deal with culture, cross-cultural discussion, diaspora. And I think it's really fun to see how that comes across both in speculative terms and in the broader terms. So I'm really excited to talk to you about it for both of those reasons.
I know, exactly. Yes. Okay. And I'm hoping you'll come back for us to talk more about speculative films in the future. So today,
especially the creepy stuff.
Yes. All right. So let's jump right into it. So for those who have not had a chance to watch The Namesake is actually based off of a best-selling novel by Jhumpa Lahiri. The film follows Ashok, who is played by Irfan Khan. Love him to pieces. And Ashma, and who is played by Tabul, who's actually really young when she's making this film, but she plays like a matriarchal person. That in itself is really interesting to me too. And basically what it does is it takes a look at, actually a multi-generational kind of, look at, you know, what's in it in a name, right?
Yeah.
So we see Ashok and Ashima from India to America and all of the hijinks that go along in the way. And at the heart of the namesake is really what is in a name? Gogol, who is played by Cal Penn, is named after, you know, this Russian author who was very influential to Ashok. And, you know, is kind of like the pinnacle, like of like this linchpin of like connecting all these different experiences. And the name holds this very deep meaning. And I feel like when the name, Ashok sits down with Gogol to kind of explain to him the deeper meaning behind it, is like there's this flash of Gogol finally understanding and getting it, right? I feel like that, you know, that is the precipice and the pinnacle, the climax of the movie, and then it just kind of continues, you know, throughout understanding that. You know, the story continues from there after introducing Ashok and Ashima, you know, chronicles then the story of Gogol's kind of cross-cultural experience between America and between India, and explores his Indian heritage. And, you know, after he gets into college, that's when he decides to go ahead and use his good name. And I don't know the cultural background behind the difference between the good name and the given name and things like that. So I'd love to go ahead and like,
yeah,
you talk a little bit more about it. Yes, yeah. We'll talk about it in a moment. But then he goes, you know, Nikhil. And so he starts being called Nick for short. And then like his white girlfriend, it calls him Nikki. And it's like, oh my God, like this is just such a mind fuck right now. But anyway. And his, you know, basically he loves architecture and things like that. And he goes into becoming like, that's his career and like wrapping around that and things like that. Being able to understand like, you know, the implications of needing to have like status and, you know, and things like, and your career and exploring that and expanding on that. But basically, you know, at that point when he has his a white American girlfriend who's wealthy, well off, right? And just completely clueless to the cultural implications, right? And we can even talk a little bit more about that later. But Gogol falls in love then after that with Maxine. And so hijinks and sadness ensue from that as well. And, you know, basically at that point, that's the turning point of him wanting to, you know, he basically does a 180 of you know, just like cultural strife and conflict within himself, going from turning his back to, you know, Indian culture to then really trying to focus on like the modernity of like crossing those two streams of being American and Indian and being able to like be both. And what does that look like? So yeah, I hope I summarized it well enough. I'd love to go ahead and talk about like our takes. So I just kind of talked about, I set it up, you know, I'd love to hear Saba from your end. Like what's your overall take about the film?
You know, I really enjoyed it and I thought it was an interesting experience to watch it on my own. And it was an even more interesting experience to watch it with my family. And I know we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but you know, I tried to make sure that I could do it both ways so that I could have a different perspective on what we were witnessing and the story that we were getting, because it is a multi-generational story that transcends time and space in some interesting ways. I really enjoyed the subtlety of the film. And, you know, Thabu did such a great job as Ashima, and Irfan Khan, who, you know, sadly passed away not long ago, you know, did such a great job as Ashok as well. And I thought their performances were so wonderful and so relatable. That word, the word relatable, right? That's the word of the season.
Yes.
But, you know, I think even if you have no experience with their culture, with Indian culture of that particular time, which I think is different from Indian culture today, right? And Indian culture in America or in other places, that, their depictions of those particular characters are so relatable to a lot of people. And they brought up really big and complicated issues of trauma. And movement and immigration and diaspora and loss, as well as belonging in ways that I think were really subtle and very well done. You know, I thought it was interesting to see their particular story against the backdrop of the experiences of their children and the movie strategies that bookended various different scenes to let us connect between those dots. I think that was really kind of wonderful. It was a slow, quiet, soft kind of movie which left you feeling a little warm, but also a little sad at the same time in the way that nostalgia does really well.
Absolutely. Back in 2006, you know, Kalpen was like hot shit with Harold and Kumar.
Yes.
Right? And it was so crazy because what I loved about it was that it depicted Asians as just as Americans, right?
Yeah.
Yes, Cal Penn is a pot smoking, you know, like just like a pothead. And he does that as well in this film too.
Pot smoking, air guitar playing dude. Right. He just wants to hang out with his friends, right?
Yes. It is relatable. I mean, like for me, of course, I was like an obedient daughter. So I you know, didn't smoke or drink or anything like that in high school or college. But, you know, like, that's not to say like that I didn't love that the representation was just that we could just be, you know, we didn't have to be like straight A student excelling or like, you know, caricatures of like, you know, in 16 Candles were just like, me love, you know, whatever, or like, me love you long time, right? Like, I was so grateful that we didn't have to just be these others and that we could just like, this is what America looks like. And actually the complicated, you know, background of like, you know, like how Indians and Chinese are the backbone of America, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But my take on the film is I really appreciated the relatability of the namesake, you know, and I love the fact that it basically doesn't treat an Asian, the Asian culture as like a monolith. And so you can really see that kind of being threaded through. And so, you know, rest in peace, Irfan Khan. Like, he was amazing in this film as a shogun. And the gentleness that they actually approached a lot of these topics of trauma, diaspora, intergenerational, interracial. You know, I really appreciated being able to kind of see the nuanced takes. And so, yes, it was like a slower film. It definitely wasn't action, but it really helped to kind of put on the map the way that we can be able to approach our own individual unique stories. So I really appreciated this film. Meera Nair is the Indian-born director, and this was not her first film at all, actually. And then, you know, and so I really appreciated just like the way that she approached it with the screenwriter, Suni Taraporevala. I probably totally butchered that.
I'm not sure either. If I see it, maybe I can get it.
Okay. But both of those, just like the combined superpowers really made it so that, you know, something that did not really exist back in 2006.
Yeah. Like it's not just a tale of immigrant suffering and woe or oppressed, you know, people needing liberation, right?
You know,
the narratives that justify war, which is often the immigrant experience in America.
Yes.
And the legacy of post-colonialism as well. And I think this allowed us to look at a human story that still takes into account all of those other tensions. I mean, we begin the movie with marches against fascism, right? And we end in these moments that are so human and so individual and interrogate our relationship to tradition and nostalgia in ways that are, you know, not, as you said, not monolithic, right? And also not, not completely removed from the human experience.
Okay, you're giving me goosebumps. I love that. I love that. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk a little bit more about like our favorite scenes in the film. Why don't you go ahead and kick it off, Saba?
Cool. So my favorite scenes are probably the ones that are bookended throughout the film in a particular way. And I think I'll give you my top three. So the very first one was the shoes. I mean, that moment in which Ashima is trying on Ashok's shoes and like feels this instant connection to him because, you know, he's got these unusual shoes that don't look like everybody else's at the time that speak to possibility and potential and choice and agency and individual expression. It's, and at the same time, intimacy, an intimacy that's only possible through a courageous experience or willingness to embrace adventure. You know, she's never met this guy before. She's going into this, like, you know, marriage-making setup opportunity here by her parents, you know, and she's never met him. And yet she feels close enough that she's willing to try on his shoes. And so there's this interesting moment in which she's testing out the possibilities or potential of intimacy in this way. I love that moment because we understand her so much in that space, and also him. She sees something beyond the typical experience of arranged marriages or, you know, the role of the wife in the family or in a particular marriage in the first place. And it shows that she's willing to fall in line in ways that make sense to her, but is willing to try things that are uniquely her own as well. We see the same kind of feeling later when she's mixing, she's making like an Indian mix with Rice Krispies and peanuts and all those other things.
Right.
There's like a million ways to call that. But, you know, if you've never eaten churva, you should try it. It's great. And if you can't find it, you can make it with Rice Krispies and some cayenne pepper. Right.
Yes. So,
but like those little moments that show that she's willing to take her experiences and adapt to them. I thought that was really, really beautiful. And comparing that to like, the son trying on the shoes after he's lost his father.
Yeah.
You know, I love that moment because we see not only this very familiar notion of walking a mile in somebody else's shoes when he tries on the shoes of his father, and all the associations that come with being in someone else's shoes, inheriting their traditions and their paths, but also a desire for intimacy, which is, you know, he's turned away from his entire life, you know, and in those moments, he wants to put on his father's shoes in this strange and empty apartment and goes immediately to his father's bed, which is, you know, totally tidy, but has the smell of him left, you know, on the pillows where he's sobbing. And it's the first time we really see him showing those connections to his father, in addition to like those moments out on the shore when they're by the water, which we end with, right?
Oh, you're going to make me cry. I mean, like, it was so, so good. I mean, like, Ashima, it does this really great, you know, like, especially what you're saying. It's just like she has this fearlessness to her, right? Like, and this bravery that kind of comes with it. It's really interesting because I think especially in 2006. I mean, I still feel like it is today. Like, there's a lot of mystery and like from Americans not really understanding arranged marriages and thinking that, like, you know, it's just like, oh, they're forced into it. And it's like, no, not necessarily. It's matchmaking, right? The woman still has the decision to go ahead and say yes.
It's like a setup or a blind date, you know?
Right, exactly. Right. And so, you know, there is that aspect of like culture and you know, I really appreciated the fact that they present Ashma at the very beginning as this very conscious, intelligent, woman. And I love her backstory, like, throughout, right? Like, and I of course, I wish there was like even more Ashima, but then it wasn't necessarily her story, but they did such a good job of just like having this like third dimensional, kind of fourth dimensional almost, like representation of Ashima, and just like a Asian woman that wasn't just like this overbearing mother. And like, you do see her maternal instincts later on, and actually, you know, it was interesting. I would definitely say like my mom was not anywhere near as chill as Ashma was. Like, you know, like, she wasn't your typical tiger mom, and I feel terrible saying that, but she wasn't, right? She wasn't like completely overbearing. She was, and I felt like she was actually pretty open to whatever the kids wanted to be able to do as long as they were happy. And I felt like that was actually a pretty progressive like take as parent and parenting in that regard. Like, I don't know, like, maybe there are more parents who are less strict, but like, that was definitely not my experience. So it was beautiful to kind of see that representation. We talk a little bit about how like the book ending kind of the bookend scenes. And I think one of the other one is Ashima singing.
That was number two on my list. Her singing, exactly. And then the weddings, right? That was number three.
The weddings are extravagant and everything like that. And being able to, the movie is so cyclical. And I feel like basically they take on this totally different paradigm shift or something like that when they show the mirrors of the two different scenes showing, you know, like being able to, you know, so when at the very beginning when they're showing off Ashima and the fact that she starts reciting this poem.
She's reciting Wordsworth, right? I mean, she is engaged with tradition in those moments, with classical singing at the beginning and the end. And then Wordsworth, which is like, you know, the other guy in the room is like mouthing the words along with him.
Oh,
and the father-in-law, like, you know, chimes in because he knows it. And they have this like interesting like connection to tradition and traditional, what we call Western culture, right?
Right,
and yet
they're
seen as perpetual foreigners. And there's such a cool moment in that. Like, I love that you're pointing that out, because I think there's such a cool moment in that, in seeing that dynamic, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, and so it was like this bittersweet moment at the very end of the film when Ashima, you know, goes back to singing, you know, like, oh, are they going to take a, you know, 40, 50-year-old, like, student? And it's like, oh, my God. Like, it was as if she, like, never – I mean, she actually is – Tabu is actually like a professional, like traditional singer, actually, like that's her career. So it's really beautiful to kind of see they lean into that. And she just has this beautiful, ethereally kind of, you know, angelic voice. It was so beautiful to kind of see that and be reminded that, you know, for me, I'm a mom. And I think one of the things that there's this aspect of asking moms to change who they are and forget who they used to be. And so you can see that in that Ashima is just like then a mom, you know, and her kids only see her as a mom. But then when they go and take their kids back to India to go ahead and look at, like, for an example, the why did my mind go blank?
The Taj Mahal. When they go to the Taj Mahal.
When they go to the Taj Mahal. And and the aspect of the sensuality that they both still have and love of each other, right? And And, you know, just that the small hand touches was like electrifying for me. I was like, holy shit, like, this is amazing. Like, I got the small little things like that that really kind of reawoke and, like, you know, this is who Ashima is. And I really appreciated that a lot of the nuanced kind of things and, you know, the fearlessness, you know, like, that can be like a whole episode alone of just, of just Ashima.
There are these beautiful, like, moments of intimacy. This depth of intimacy was so apparent in details like the way they touched hands, the way they talked to each other, and even the sort of coy, playful way she says, oh, you want me to say I love you like the Americans do?
Right?
Like, you know, exactly. It was just like this, the ways in which they expressed desire, longing, devotion were so different. And you could tell from the earlier scene of her singing, where she was very classically trained and functioning to, you know, to do everything correctly and technically right. And then we have that last scene in which she kind of resumes her life and she's singing again, but there's so much sorrow and grief and maturity and life in those voices. And, you know, we can't help but think about how literature and art in general really hold the experiences of humans beyond their own time and transcend the sort of mundane struggles that we go through and really give us this transcendent pain and longing and desire. And it's all tied up in like naming too, right?
Yes.
Notes, the notes in the music, the names of the songs, the names of the characters and the poems that kind of all bleed together to remind us that intimacy is so much more than materiality, which I think is another interesting conflict in that particular story, especially in the ways in which it engages the American dream. So.
Right, exactly. Yes, exactly. I mean, like, and it was really interesting because then, you know, Gogol's character tells his girlfriend, like, don't kiss me, don't touch me.
Right.
Like, those are things that are not acceptable. And then she goes and just like hugging everyone. Right. Like,
right.
So it just felt like, you know, there was like this naivety maybe, but then also I felt like after Gogol tells her, like, don't do that. She just like, and I felt like it was like violence. It was like aggressive, you know?
I agree completely. Cause it wasn't ignorance, you know? He's told her, please don't do these things. It's going to be offensive, you know? And then she chooses to disregard those things entirely, purposefully kissing the parents on the face, calling them by their first names.
I mean,
come on, right? Like, I was so horrified that she did that. And he kept moving her hand away and she kept insisting.
I know.
As if to assert her own cultural dominance over that particular space and power.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, and I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at how the family dynamics work too, right? Because then you have the best friend, the librarian, the mother's best friend, and she is sensitive and caring and open-minded and talks to Ashima without seeing her as this foreign alien object that she needs to, you know, colonize, right? Which is unfortunately what Maxine is doing, in my opinion. And we see that again at the funeral too, you know? She shows up wearing the clothes that are inappropriate and refusing to participate in a subtle manner, right, at all. And it's not ignorance, but violence, a subtle kind of violence, but violence nonetheless, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, okay, so we talked about some of our favorite scenes and some of the things that we really loved about the film. Was there anything about the film that you didn't necessarily love?
There was, you know, and because I love what this film did and how it sort of showed up on the stage to present, you know, the sort of South Asian American experience, in a time when we don't get a whole lot of that. We get a lot of like, you know, British and South Asian stuff. We don't get a whole lot of it in America. I find that the representation of women particularly was problematic. Neither were they, you know, oppressed, veiled women in need of freedom, nor were they fully independent, like agents of their own life and culture. The closest we get is Thabu, but the first generation women, they could practically be interchangeable in some ways. You know, Sonia, it took me a really long time to remember what Sonia's name even was.
Oh my God.
Until I saw
it
written
down. I was like, oh shit,
right?
What was it? Yes.
And when I watched the film with like my niece and my sister and my mom, we kind of watched it together. You know, my niece said, what is going on? You know, my niece is, she's young. She's really interested in woke culture specifically. And she kept saying, they're not woke. They're not even telling us her name. You know, like that was her comment. And I thought that was really great because, you know, all we see of the sister is these moments in which she is in conflict with the plot line or the storyline.
Yeah.
We don't get a whole lot about her. And even Maxine, we don't get a whole lot about her either. So they're either these like virtuous mother figures or they're, you know, tarts who are, you know, dragging people into this other direction, or they don't have a personality at all. And I thought it was, I did not like the representation of women other than Thabu.
Yeah. You know, it received a, let's see, an 85% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
wow, it was, did it really?
Really high rating. That's impressive. I thought it was going to be lower. Exactly. But it was really well regarded, critically acclaimed film. And so, you know, I definitely feel like it was, there was like touchstone, I guess, if you will, of like it appearing in Hollywood. So I think part of it too is like, you know, Indian representation and is like, you guys have Bollywood, right? So it's just
right,
like,
right.
There's that whole like, and in fact, almost like Bollywood's almost is basically bigger, I would almost say, than Hollywood.
I think it is bigger than Hollywood. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, it's just like, well, we don't really need to break into American cinema. We have our own, right? So I think, so there's that aspect of like what, you know, how to commercialize South Asian narrative. So it's just, right. It is really interesting to kind of to skirt that.
Yeah, it's interesting to think of what audience this was actually created for. You know, I think the novel, you know, I did read the novel. I remember when it came out, you know, and I remember, you know, The Interpretive Maladies, which was a short story collection that preceded this one. And, you know, and then this one, it was printed in The New Yorker as a short story and then later expanded into a novel and then adapted for the screen. So, you know, I've seen it in like different versions and it feels different on the page. It really does. And I think that, you know, it's interesting to think about who the audience is. You know, was it a white audience that they had in mind for this? You know, if I can be blunt, right?
But right, no, exactly.
It feels that way to me, you know?
The budget that they received for this was about $9.5 million, you know, and it's very hard to be able to get financing for stories that don't look exactly like the producers who are the executive producers that they're going and getting the funding for, right?
Yes.
So yeah, you know, I there is maybe some aspects of the fact that there was some whitewashing needed to be able to be in there so that they could make it a little bit more marketable, right? The fact that people who weren't double did not get a fully realized like representation in the film, like, right? But I want to actually touch back on what you were talking about, like having that multi-generational viewing, you know, like, and kind of figure out how can we tie that to like the fact of like diaspora, like, you know, and the representation, maybe like could you tell like the difference between like your grandma watching it versus your niece and like you and your mom, like, you know?
So, you know, it was my mom and me and my sister and my niece. We watched it. And so, unfortunately my grandmother's not with us anymore. So, you know, but I would have loved to see her take on it. It was an interesting experience for a lot of reasons. You know, my folks, came to the U.S. in the 60s and 70s, and their experiences look nothing like what we saw on the screen. You know, my parents did have different backgrounds, different ways of connecting to culture. And, you know, one of the things my mom noticed is that she was really surprised not to see the character of Ashima assimilating more in terms of clothing and culture and things like that, because I think there were different groups of people who immigrated for different reasons and in different ways, and they all had different takes on how to take more progressive ideals that were more common in the 60s and 70s than what we have right now. And I do think that later immigration brought people who have different attitudes and approaches towards assimilation in different ways and different relationships to colonizers, right, that shape their experiences, you know. My folks were born before Indian independence.
Wow.
Like, they grew up in a completely different culture than, you know, what India looks like today and now. They were very cosmopolitan in their approaches, lived in other cities and European cities and showed up in America and did not hold on to their culture in the same way that I think, what we saw on the screen. And unfortunately, the representations of the South Asian experience are that everyone who comes here is an immigrant in the same way. I do love seeing that, you know, there's this kind of value given to education and to culture and to tradition and to awareness that I think was possible there too. And I think, you know, my mom was just surprised. She's like, what? Why isn't she wearing like
a t-shirt
pants?
And jeans?
Why isn't she wearing pants? You know,
yes.
Cold there. Why is she wearing a sari? But I think there are different attitudes to how people chose to express themselves in terms of fashion and culture and things like that too. You know, and my niece was like, why are the women just, you know, so empty? Why can't we see anything about them? understand what's going on. And, and my sister was noticing, my sister's a physician. She's noticing elements on the screen that have to do with like the hospital moments, right? Like what happens when we see resilience and how, care and treatment come across, when you see, people of color in hospitals are not often taken as seriously. If he didn't have to wait in a super long line to get treated for his heart attack,
right,
he might not have died, you know?
Exactly.
And I thought that was a really interesting element to me, that we all picked up on different things, that showed how even in the same household and in the same family, our approach to, the experience of living here and being here wasn't the same, you know?
Oh my gosh. So if your niece is 13, this film was made before she was even born. So.
Yes. And she commented, she's like, why are we watching this movie that was made before I was even born? But she could relate to it in this really interesting way and like talked about it as well. And, you know, I enjoyed watching it with family and I enjoyed thinking about what those experiences looked like. And yet this movie, I think, did a really weird thing by ignoring, the clash between class and culture, which, you know, they brought up only briefly in those moments where we see Maxine and her family and her life and the ways in which that, you know, wealth is manifest. I mean, Ashok and Ashima live in a very large house. Ashok is a professor, which is not an easy gig,
you know?
Or easy to come by, right? You know,
right.
And you know, they're wealthy. She doesn't have to work to support her family. You know, they're in this space, but the conversation between class and culture, there was an elision there that I think was an interesting thing to think about, which I think influenced the way multiple people looked at it.
I love that. We're going to go ahead and take a short break and we'll be back. Experiences by Kay is the Bay Area luxury picnic business that can be set up just about anywhere, from the beach, park, your backyard, and more. Simply go to the website, book your picnic, show up, and enjoy a good time with your friends, worry-free. Great for birthdays, anniversaries, proposals, you name it. Go to experiencesbyk.com right now for your upcoming occasion, and check out Experiences by Kay on Instagram. That's Experiences by Kay.
Have you always wanted to enjoy those delicious Taiwanese pineapple cakes but couldn't find a plant-based option to suit your dietary needs? I certainly have. It's literally the first thought that comes to my brain every morning. Well, I'm glad I found Annie's Tea Cakes. Annie's Tea Cakes is an Oakland-based food company on a mission to provide plant-based Chinese food options to the world. These vegan Taiwanese pineapple cakes can be available by placing an order through annie'steacakes.com. A portion of all profits go towards organizations supporting local sustainable agriculture. Again, go to annie'steacakes.com. That's Annie, spelled A-N-N-I-E, right now to get your vegan pineapple cakes.
All right, everyone, and we're back. So thank you so much for kind of talking about like the aspect of multi-generational viewing in this with your family. I want to go ahead and talk a little bit then about like interracial relationships that was brought up in the film itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we talked about like Gogo falling in love, or Nikki at the point,
right.
falling in love with Maxine and her relationship with his relationship with that family, right? Like, I feel like one of the things that was really interesting is that, you know, you don't really see interracial relationships kind of being brought up in film when it comes to like South Asians or like Asians in general. They usually, you know, when it's a white mm-hmm. girl, blonde hair, blue eyes, like the, you know, the Asian people, they don't get the girl, right?
So right.
It was really interesting to see that actually. And the only other real like film that I kind of see that kind of blossoming was The Big Sick.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, in the movie The Big Sick, Kumail, he plays comedian, and basically it's kind of like an autobiographical film. It actually is about him and his now wife, but basically mm-hmm. it was really interesting to kind of be able to see this is the another, this is like the only other film where you see a South Asian guy having a relationship with a white woman. And, you know, it was really interesting to kind of see the way that it was portrayed. Like for me personally, like I'm married to a white guy as well. And there was, is definitely like misunderstanding, misfirings around like cultural differences between us, right? Like in my culture, when the women get married, the guys are supposed to pay a bride price. And there's a There's all this like conflict around, like for me personally, I did not want my husband to pay for it because my my understanding of it, especially at that time, was more like, you know, this is my worth and everything. And I hated the idea that for me, I was this commodity for my parents to like trade.
Right.
And so, you know, I basically told my parents, like, we're not going to pay a dowry or bride price. And, you know, so there's like that cultural aspect of it, you know, that about like interracial relationships. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked a little bit about it earlier as well already, but, you know, what are some of your takeaways from like the interracial relationship like that was being represented in the film?
Yeah. You know, I thought it was a really interesting one because I think, you know, you see in a lot of movies that depict Indians or Pakistanis in the Western environment, it's always, especially if you see like Muslims, there's always this tension of the wicked white girl, right? You know, stealing away from the culture, which is an interesting thing to me because, you know, in like in my parents' generation or even in my grandparents' generation, I saw lots of interracial relationships, like in my own experience of like people in, you know, in life. And many of my, cousins and even aunts and uncles with Asian heritage married people who did not have Asian heritage. You know, there's a lot of like open-endedness in that. And yet, yeah, the depiction that we see on the screen is often that it is problematic. And it sort of invites that kind of colonizer mentality. I think that's sort of, you can't escape it, you know, like the post-colonial influence is big, you know, where people are still pushing away from England in a lot of ways, you know, like, so I think that's worth thinking about, when we are considering how, the nuances of engagement with people are at stake there, right? Like, I think if people, one of the big myths in the movie that I think is dispelled is that cultural heritage is somehow going to equal compatibility because it doesn't, you know?
Right.
You know, Sonia, who we hardly see in the movie at all in any meaningful way, is happily married to somebody who is not Bengali and who's not Indian, right? And Ashima is not bothered by this fact at all. It's not a big deal. Ashok gives his son a Russian name, right? Like, which is, you know, like it's such a big deal. Like, it's so important to him. He left because he wanted to see the world. He wanted to see America. He wanted to see other places. He wasn't interested in holding on to this identity, but it almost seems like Gogol / Nikhil, and even Sonia are pushing against this idea of what culture demands of them that their own culture has not given them.
Yes.
Right? You know, so it's like, Even Maxine, you know, she's responding to, oh, I have to push against this culture because it's repressive and it's bad and I need to enlighten the unenlightened, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Whereas, you know, like his parents, you know, Gogol's parents are just, they're totally willing to tolerate her, you know, weird foibles and bad behavior. And at the end of the day, you know, she just outs herself as being a sort of a racist, right?
Yes.
You know, and by being unwilling to respect and honor the nuances of their tradition. Like, she's just kind of fetishized her boyfriend in a strange way.
No, absolutely.
You know? And, you know, automatically looks at Gogol's mother and starts reducing her clothing to museum artifacts.
Right.
Which is, like, so offensive,
gosh.
You know?
It's super offensive. Yes, exactly. And the thing is, like, did it come from a place of, like, genuine care? I didn't necessarily believe that Maxine felt like, you know, I definitely feel like, you know, it was like Nikki was like hers, right? Mm-hmm. And then all these other things that are attached to him definitely was like this, the othering, right? Again, yet again that we see. So, you know, I felt like, I didn't want Maxine to have like a three-dimensional character anyway, but I just felt like I thought it was an appropriate caricature because it was something that was relatable too, right?
Sure. The relationship wasn't fully developed, You know,
he was
a mask of himself with her. So they couldn't have had much of a relationship beyond
right.
that, you know?
Right, absolutely. I mean, because especially, you know, when you're thinking about like when the book was written, when the movie came out, like there was like this huge cultural appropriation of like South Asian and Indian culture, or, you know, like yoga, like beer yoga, goat yoga. I mean, like people wearing bindis, like all these, right? Like all of these things. And it was just kind of like, I definitely felt like it was an appropriate kind of commentary about how, like, you know, like American culture emasculates the men, culturally appropriates, like, not only food, but also just like, you know, exercise and clothing, right? And there's this aspect of like, oh, you know, I'm so cool because I am like so attuned with my, like, I'm a yogi, but I'm white and I grew up in like the mountains of Santa Cruz, right? Like things like
right.
that. Like it makes me feel so crazy because, like, especially out here in the Bay Area and in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's like this huge wanting of being able to like just like claim Indian culture as like their own, and like having that, I don't know, maybe I'm just like rambling at this point, but like, you know, like the idea of like British colonization, it still is like prevalent in our today's society because of the cultural appropriation that we still see.
No, I completely agree with you, and I think we see that throughout the narratives of this film in a really interesting way. You know, they are reading British poetry. They're reading, like, that's like lines on Tintern Abbey or something, right? That's what they're reading, right? And I mean, you know, they're not reading, you know, Tagore or, you know, or Kalidasa. Their proficiency, and there's a weird moment too when they're like kind of showing off all of, you know, the accomplishments of the young women or of the young men in that conversation. You know, what are they worth? And it's almost like, what their worth is happens to be related to the ways in which they navigate tradition in an interesting way. And this, you know, this film did not talk about dowries, which I think is a big deal in Indian culture, whether it's, you know, Muslim culture or Hindu culture or just across the continent. I think, you know, the issue of dowry comes up a lot and, in that particular space. And that's one that, you know, that doesn't seem to connect with American culture at all. So there's an interesting space there in that discussion. And I think Maxine was just very willing to see all of Gogol's family as, you know, just these colorful accessories in the background of his
yes.
life,
oh my
which
gosh,
she wanted
yes.
to yank him away from. And he was willing to go with it for, you know, when they were waiting for him to call to say that he arrived there,
yeah.
when the mother, when, you know, when Ashima tried to call Gogol on his birthday, she couldn't even reach him.
I know.
And he's celebrating intimately with her family in this other kind of way. Like he was almost living this weird double life that was not authentic, you know? And I think, you know, the major flaw in their relationship wasn't that they were like, you know, from racial backgrounds that were different, but that they weren't truly themselves, you know? Whereas, you know, Sonia and her husband, in the movie, had a completely different experience. You know, she married somebody who was not from the same culture and it worked because they were, you know, willing to go with it. And he was willing to show up and say, I don't know anybody's name. Oh, just call everybody auntie or uncle and you'll be fine.
Exactly,
right. You know,
exactly.
Like, everyone gets that. You know?
Exactly. So I love that. And so I'm going to pivot now to talking about Moshma then. She's played by actress, Zuleika Robinson. And a little bit of background about her. She is a British actress.
Mm-hmm.
And she grew up in Thailand, Singapore, and Malaysia. And she is, her mom is Indian Burmese and her father is English. But she also has like Scottish and Iranian like background. So it was really interesting to kind of see, because she looks so eclectic and different, right? And so it's really interesting to kind of see, you know, this actress kind of coming in and embodying. You know, like she's like a Bengali girl, right?
Right.
Who's obsessed with like French culture and things like that. And actually how that comes back into the fold and kind of, but you know, they take that first date and she doesn't even remember Gogol at that point. She's like, oh, I said that.
Right.
And you know, so then at that point, you know, it's really interesting because what you're saying is like, Gogol was actually wanting to re-embrace his heritage. And you kind of maybe see that same thing with Moshima. But then, you know, there is that aspect of being an immigrant and being versus a first generation born in the U.S. I really kind of, I'd love to go ahead and hear your take on their relationship.
Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting to me because I thought that they were functioning in this sort of dynamic that seemed to imply both of them have had bad luck in some way in love. But you know, they're both kind of rebounding off of like other relationships in this conversation. And they thought, okay, we have this cultural thing. This is going to be the thing that connects us. And it just wasn't, you know, and I think I think this is something that, you know, first generation Americans can kind of relate to in a big way. Just because someone has the same heritage as you does not mean you're going to connect. I can't, I could speak to that, but I won't directly. But I think, you know, I think many of us can relate to that idea where, you know, and so I think, you know, there's a lot at stake that isn't just heritage or background, that matters. And I think, you know, she is, Moshima's character is kind of obsessed with being French in the same way that I think, you know, Gogol is obsessed with being American and not doing anything that compromises his Americanness in any way. So he's living as this like facade of himself, which influences the ways in which he has relationships with other people, and what he does with those particular relationships. And I think that, you know, Moshimi is doing the same thing, in that she just wants very much to be French. And so of course she's going to go move forward into, I mean, having an affair with her old boyfriend because that makes her feel authentically like the culture that she's adopted in a strange way. And I think that plays a part in how they relate to each other. In fact, she just exploits Gogol's weirdness as a tidbit in a party, which is like this moment of grief for him. It's such a big deal, you know, losing the father, losing the patriarch of the family is a terrible, difficult thing, especially in immigrant communities and families where so much of that relies upon so much of that determines family structure and the way we understand our senses of self. And especially for Gogol being, you know, the firstborn son, there's this shocking moment where he's shaved his head and come home, you know, for the funeral, which shows that he is really trying to relate in an authentic way to the things that matter to the people in his life. But neither of these relationships do that, right? Neither Moshimi nor Maxine, because Maxine just wants to steal him away from the culture, whereas Moshimi, she's just kind of like, oh, I don't want to be the person that makes samosas every Thursday. I don't think he ever even asked her to be that kind of person. So she's imposing these ideas on herself, you know, and choosing these behaviors, like sitting there smoking cigarettes in a very particular way. And he's drawn to her, you know, her desire for sensuality and her desire for connection with the outside world, but not even to her. So it's like two masks that are kind of, you know, in conversation with each other, right?
You are making so much sense because basically what's interesting about their relationship is like she is like undoubtedly westernized, right? And he's American, right? And so he feels like there's this connection. You can be able to see it. Like he's like, okay, she's Bengali, check that box. But then also she's more Americanized or like, you know, westernized.
Or westernized, right?
Right, exactly. So it's just like, okay, so then I can still be able to hold on to the things that I love about myself, right? And I think there's this dynamic, like, so for me growing up, you know, I was never Hmong enough and I was never American enough. And it wasn't until it wasn't until much, much later in my life that I finally realized, you know, there's a hyphen for a reason, like Asian American, Hmong American. Like it's not that I'm one or the other. It's that I can be able to be both. Mm-hmm. And I think that was something that was really, really like pivotal for me to really understand. And I feel like the film actually was ahead of its time in that regard, like being able to like straddle the fact that, you know, you don't have to choose between. And in fact, his parents never made them choose. So there's all of this weight, especially when I was growing up, there was all this weight on my shoulders to feel like I had to be the bearer of both cultures. Like I have to be the spokesperson of being Hmong to my American friends. And I felt like I had to be able to be American and bring my culture to like the 21st century, right? And things like that. And I felt like there was this unspoken like obligation. Like no one asked me to do that, but I felt like I needed to do that. And so you can, that was one thing I did really relate to in the film.
I love that you said that, because I think that I think American culture makes a lot of demands upon Asian Americans to be the ambassadors of their culture, and their culture in a way that is imagined by white Americans specifically, not even their actual culture. So in a way, like, you know, I think if we choose to express ourselves from the reality and actuality and truth of our experiences, that still isn't play acting it the right way for the audience. And I think that definitely plays a part in how the relationships are depicted. You're so right about that. And I like that the movie asks us to think about that tension between what we demand of ourselves, what our culture and heritage and ancestors demand of us, you know, and what the people to whom we must sort of confess ourselves sort of expect of us, you know, like, first we have to prove how brown we are before we can even prove that we're human.
Oh my gosh.
You know, as writers, like as a writer, that has definitely been my experience, you know?
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm looking at our show notes, and one of the things that you wrote was like the depiction of women oftentimes was problematic and sometimes shallow. Tell me a little bit more about like how you felt like the men representation can be as well, like in film and cinema and things like that.
So, you know, I mean, I think like I'm comparing this to movies like East is East and Bend It Like Beckham. And the conversation, I think, in East is East and Bend It Like Beckham really, I think they're more nuanced portraits of all the characters and all the dynamics in general. But I think that's partly because it's in conversation with the colonial past and problems of heritage that relate to that. Whereas in this one, we don't have that sense of the past kind of encroaching on the conversation. I mean, the American dream can be whatever it wants to be, right? You know, there's the guy with the classic American car. In the suburbs, you know, like there's that one scene in the movie where they're doing that. Whereas, you know, inside they're having like, you know, this baby naming party, right? With the idea of the name that you have at home versus the name that you have for the outside world, which, you know, I think is something that you see a lot in India. Like it's not something that we had in our family. Like my name is just my name. Although my dad had a nickname at work, but that's just because people, in Texas like to not, they like to anglicize names.
Yes,
so, you know, they just called him what they called him. He was an engineer. And My dad's coworkers called him Russ because they couldn't say Razvi. So, you know, right. But, you know, so like there is this weird sense of that kind of situation. We never understand whether, Gogol's father faces racism as a professor. And it would surprise me if he didn't, you know, because I'm a professor now in 2021 and I experience racism all the time. So it would be really surprising to me to think that it doesn't come up in his life. But he seems like the kind of person who's just willing to take it in stride, like he did the vandalism of the mailbox in this particular way. Whereas that issue bothered Gogol and Sonia so much, right? They were like angry about it, where he just, you know, tolerated it. I think there is a sense of like hidden depths that we see in Ashok's character, which I think is really valuable. And I think there is a sense that, you know, Gogol has not yet reached that kind of potential. We're willing to forgive him a whole lot of pettiness in his life, because I think he's so petty for so much of his life, and
he's so insufferable. And I feel I was so pissed off at Gogol. Like, I mean, Cal Penn does a great job of
he does
him, right? I mean, like, basically Cal Penn had like basically begged to be able to get this this role. And he does it so well. Like, he really does. He just nails it. And, you know, and I definitely feel like if we didn't talk enough about Ashok, because Efron Khan's, like, depiction was so perfect, because he shows, like, this conflicted, like, youth as well. He's like, oh, he just reads what he doesn't do or anything. And it wasn't until, you know, the train uncle.
Right?
Like, you need to go and explore, do this, you know? And where basically he was, you know, when having that intimate scene with Gogol saying, you know, like, this writer saved my life, right? Bringing it down and just like really trying to make him understand, you know, yeah, they're going to go get ice cream, but really it's because like, it was almost like this precursor to knowing, like, you know, I'm not going to be here long. I feel like you're maybe ready to know, right? And because any other time, Gogol's insufferable character would not have understood or really felt this connection. Because even after, it's interesting, because even after he tells Gogol like how he got his name and why he got his name, you still see Nichols' character like have this character arc, right? Like of like still not being there
not
for his family, just not getting it. And it wasn't until he was pushed by his father's death that he finally, right? And so it was like, that really like encapsulated the film for me, like right there, mm-hmm. those moments like really made me feel that connection. And you can be able to finally see like, okay, all this character development and strife of Gogol finally coming to a head and meet and understanding. And you can see like that trauma that happens though, is like he really tries to rewrite his character to be a little bit, to be more authentic. And I think maybe like be more like his father that he never really could be before. Mm-hmm. And so I really, you know, and like sitting, when he was sitting in his, you know, childhood room again, and he finds that book and the dedication right from his father, which is like, oh,
which he'd never even looked at, right? He'd never even looked at it until that moment, you know?
That was a really pivotal moment, I felt like. And then it was like it all hit him. And he's like, wait, maybe I need to be more, you know, for him. Like
more like my dad, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that was really interesting to kind of see that.
But his understanding of what that meant was also like weirdly shallow and lacking in self-reflection. Because, you know, when the dad told him this amazing story about how he got his name and this trauma that he'd lived and survived and what that meant for him, like how important that was, instead of being like, wow, that's an amazing story, he's like, is that what you think about when you say my name? Like, he's just so,
like, oh my
God. So petty. He's just so petty. It's like, he's a really, really good acting, you know,
in that. Right?
But like, even then he refused to accept it, you know, just refused to accept it until he got to this point where he had to face what that meant, whatever that meant, whether it was, you know, like heritage. And I think he was confused about it because his father wasn't just his heritage, right? Neither of his parents were like monolithic Indian people. They were like different and unusual and interesting.
Absolutely.
And he's like, let me just overcorrect myself now and just become this other thing. And oops, that didn't work out in my life, right?
Yes,
so I wonder
exactly.
What will happen next on his path, you know?
Yeah.
And he's off on his own journey of adventure and self-discovery in those last moments, which might bring him to something more authentic. So he comes right back to the train.
Yes.
Which was a much more authentic experience than, you know, oh, it's he's not coming back to tradition. He's coming back to travel, right?
I love that. And so it was interesting. It was like the namesake came out. Then 2 years later, Obama becomes president.
And oh my God, that's right.
It's
wow.
So crazy, right? And so, and then Cowpen actually takes a break from acting to go and join like the Obama administration. So it was really interesting. Like he did do several movies in between, right? He did one more Harold and Kumar. Like,
right. Which is fun. It's a fun movie.
know, like, but... He did some more Harold and Kumar before he actually leaves acting for, or takes a short sabbatical from it. But it was really interesting to kind of see like his character development and like Cowpen's like career development actually. And so like the fact that like for me the most memorable though of is definitely the namesake for Cowpen. And so but he does such a good job of just playing this like angsty petty teen and you know going into then becoming a little bit more self-actualized. And I really that journey for me felt really authentic to like my own experience too. Like there was definitely this like a rejection of like, oh, you know, I'm not Hmong, you know, like that kind of thing. And like I don't know why I felt like there was a period in my life where I rejected it, but then after some time passed I was like, why am I doing that? Like I'm shutting off a whole section of who I am. And then it was about rediscovery and like uncovering all of that and really feeling like, okay, you know what? I know who I can be. Right. And then it just feels like I felt like I leveled up. Right. Like, I think that was one thing I felt like I had to see this movie several times to really appreciate like just the inflections of the way that the American experience kind of changes over time, right? So, you know, watching it more recently versus watching it back
when
in 2000 and, six, and then you know like I've watched it some many times, but it was like at every showing that I watched it, it was a different point of my life where I definitely felt like I was a different person at each viewing. So I really appreciate that we're talking about it today and have a having a chance to actually review it. Well, we're going to have to end it there. But thank you so much, Saba. I really enjoyed this conversation with you. Is there anywhere that our listeners can be able to connect with you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have a website. You can find me on my website. It's sabarazvi.com. You can find me online. Just, you know, look up some of my stuff. And, you know, you can, I have books out there. You can read them if you want to. Some of them are about cultural exchange and conversation, and some are not. So sabarezvi.com would be the easiest way to find me. And just click around. If you want to know more, you can reach out to me, sabarezvi@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So that'll go ahead and end our show today. Please feel free to continue listening to Real Asian Podcasts and supporting us. Have a good day.
Hey, rap heads. If you really want to support us, follow and subscribe to our podcast now. And don't forget to review our show on Apple Podcasts. We'd love to hear from you.